What are you doing?
The second he turned the camera on.
Oh, God. Why? Why?
There is gnashing of teeth.
It's not bothering you.
At the Prager home.
There's nothing happening.
The voice in the background is my beloved wife chastising Snoopy for not staying in the bed and leaving the moment the camera was turned on. You are behind the scenes, truly, at a fireside chat. We have a fireside, and you will have a chat, but you don't have a dog. Our bulldog is still in puppy phase and has no interest in sleeping through or lying through this. Megan is currently using both arms, not just the Megan arm, to push Snoopy into position. Snoopy's interest in being in that position is nil. Zero. Nada. Is he in the picture? All right. That's the man. Now, if I rub him, he might stay here the entire chat.
You just have to lean over a bit.
Yes, more than a bit, but yeah, well, a bit. Yeah, you're right. Anyway, hi, everybody. Dennis Prager, Fireside Chat, number 318. All right.
That's right.
I was told that beforehand. My friends, this is a funny moment for me because I always begin with comments, and I will today too, and then I take your questions. So there's so much going on, needless to say. So much of it is awful. And yet, I literally on the way home from my radio show, I came up with a topic that I'd like to discuss, which has nothing to do, certainly not directly, with anything that is going on now. It has to do with you and life. Well, I'll tell you specifically what triggered it. I enjoy, as everyone pretty much knows, anyone who has heard anything or read anything, you know how involved I am in music, and especially classical music, and I conduct orchestras periodically, and I have a very, very elaborate audio system. So I turned on the Symphony Hall station on my music app, on the app that brings in, you know, hundreds of stations. The reason I like doing that rather than playing what I want to hear is I like to hear things that I don't know or things I do know, but with a different performer or a different orchestra, a different conductor, a different pianist, whatever it might be, and seeing if I like it. So what came on? One of my two favorite composers and the one that has always been my favorite, and that is Franz Joseph Haydn, H-A-Y-D-N, Haydn, who wrote 104 symphonies. He's the father of the symphony, the father of the string quartet, the father of the piano trio. The guy, you may not have heard of him, but this is the way I put it. When I want to feel joy of life, I listen to Haydn. And when I want to get closer to God, I listen to Bach. That's the way I put it. And my third favorite is Beethoven. That is just pure everything. Beauty, power, inspiring. Okay, those are my three favorites, but I love many. Why am I telling you this? As soon as it came on, my mood was elevated. Now, that could happen with all sorts of music. It's not only classical. I am perfectly aware of the many genres of music that touch people's emotions and hearts. And I know that, and I think it's great. I am not a snob when it comes to, I do believe classical Western music is the greatest music ever written, but it doesn't mean there isn't other wonderful, sometimes even great music. Of course there is, even some non-Western. But within the West, you know, if you're moved by music, that's great. But why then am I talking to you about this, especially given how much there is to talk about? I did a broadcast, I'm sure, I did a fireside chat on what does it mean to be a conservative, that you want to conserve the best and pass it on to the next generation. There is nothing more beautiful, a gift to the next generation of human beings, your children and others' children and grandchildren, than to conserve that which has been the best. The best art, the best literature, the best music, the best ideas, the best religious practices and insights, the best. That is the great task, in my view, of every generation, whether you have children or not, is to pass on the best of the past. If others will also enjoy what is being done at the present, that's great. Sometimes something done in the present will even be as great as something that was done in the past. I don't deny the ability of the present to produce greatness, but it's pretty rare, obviously. So I was thinking, there is so much depth available to human beings, and so many don't have it. I know that there are people who, no matter how much they tried, they could not love classical music. I have accepted that. I have a dear friend from high school. I tried to get him to like classical music in high school. As soon as I would turn it on, I knew his mind wandered to medieval Lithuania, which, I'm kidding, because his connection to medieval Lithuania was non-existent, but I'm just using an example. And if you are listening in Lithuania, this is just a fun thing. It could have been medieval Congo or medieval New Jersey, okay? But there was no medieval New Jersey. There was a medieval Jersey. We live in the age of, did you offend anybody? Yeah. It's sad. It's really sad. So I gave up on him. He doesn't have, I would say, even the ability to love or be moved by Beethoven and Haydn and Bach and so on. He's a wonderful, deep human being. This just doesn't touch him. I have made peace with the fact that about half of the world or half of my own society will just not fall in love with classical music. But that means half would. And I'm using this as an example of you asking yourself the following question. Do I want to live as deep, I love that word, as deep a life as I can in the limited time I have in this existence? Deep. So what is deep? Why don't we answer first, what is shallow? Okay. And by the way, there's a room for the shallow. For example, I can't argue that watching a football game makes you deeper. Okay. But I totally get that you love it. I follow sports during playoff season. I even follow the World Cup. This disappoints many of my American viewers and listeners that I would love soccer, but I love team sports generally more than individual sports. That's why my real love has been all of my life ice hockey. And I fully acknowledge I'm not deeper after watching a hockey game. So there's room for non-deep joy. Of course there is. Just you want to tune out, you don't want to think about the great issues of life, but there's got to be a sort of limit on how much shallow entertainment one has in one's life. You have to decide what that limit is, but it is worthy of your asking, what is the limit? Because if you, let us say you love football, okay, whether it's soccer or American football, After three games, let's say you watch three games in one day, would you say that's excessive? Excessive? I would. This is the issue of what I write about in my happiness book, Fun Versus Happiness. I am all for fun, and I want to talk to you about fun, because fun has a real place in life. But they're not the same thing. Generally speaking, people are not happier after fun. They're happier after deep. But they're not happier after fun. But fun has a place. There's no question about it. So the question is, do you want to be happy? People all say yes, but they don't do anything about it. They confuse fun with happiness. So can you combine fun and happiness? And I will return to the excessive part in a moment. And the answer is yes. This is how to do it. Pursue that which brings you happiness and make it as much fun as you can. So I'll give you a trivial, but most examples will sound trivial. So one of the reasons I got into fountain pens, which most people don't even know exist, let alone are into, is that I am old enough that my first, whenever I would write something, there was no word processing in computers. They didn't exist. And I was not a touch typist, so I would write out by hand my first draft. By the way, The Economist just had an article that writing cultivates the brain more than typing, more than using a computer or a phone. And that is true. I, to this day, write notes. I don't use many, but I use almost every speech that I give, and I've given thousands, I do have notes. The notes are just subject headings, so I don't forget each topic I want to address in that talk. Most of my notes actually fit on a business card. That's how, but it's truly important to me to have those notes so that I don't have to think, what else did I want to say? I could think on saying it as best as possible. And I write it. I always choose to write it rather than type it and print it. It somehow embeds itself better in my mind when I write it. In any event, what did I do when I wrote and wrote and wrote? I realized I got to make writing more fun. So it was more fun to use fountain pens than ballpoint pens. It was more fun to use all these different color inks that you can use. It's an almost infinite number of colors and inks out there. And I made it fun. And I would do that even with my word processing. Sometimes I would use different fonts just to have more fun. I try to make my radio show fun. Anyone who works on my show know it is fun to work with me, and it's deliberate. I want my work to incorporate fun. That's when fun is best, when you're doing something deep and you're having fun doing it. Now, you're not always having fun doing it. There are deep things that are not fun. It is not fun taking care of a crying child. It deepens you, but it's hard to imagine what fun there is in it. I know about it. I'm a parent. So in light of all of that, if you can combine depth and fun, not only in terms of the work you do, but even the fun things you do. So like music, one of the reasons I love classical music is it's deep, but I also love it. In other words, it touches my brain and my heart. Most popular music just touches your heart. And that's fine. I told you already, I'm totally at peace with that. It's good for you. But wherever you can combine both, if you could read a deep work of fiction or a just a nothing novel, there's place for nothing novels. I'm not for banning them. Well, that's obvious. I'm not for banning them. I'm not for your banning them from your life. Choose the deeper if you can. A deeper life, a life of cultivating artistic depth and literary depth and religious depth. Look, you know, I believe that ultimately the Bible-based world produces a better world. But there are a lot of people whose religion is not deep. It's pretty superficial. It's sort of, as I've often pointed out, God is a celestial butler. Gee, I'll ask God for things and, you know, hope he comes through. That's fine to ask God for things, although I do it very little. My motto is I'm much more interested in what God wants from me than what I want from God. By the way, if that constituted your entire religious outlook, you would be a better religious person. If you are more interested in what God wants from you than what you want from God. But that's an example of every area of life can have superficial or deep. And if you choose the deep, you will be happier. And needless to say, you will be deeper. People will find you more interesting, is among its benefits, I might add. So I was just thinking about that. There is no teaching of depth any longer, at least in American schools. I can't speak for the schools of all the countries that you folks are listening in. But in American schools, there's no depth. There was. Kids were expected to read the greatest works that have been written, and then to write about them, and then to discuss them. But not anymore. Now it's, gee, how do you feel? But you know what? I'm not interested in how you feel as much as I am about how Shakespeare feels. Because Shakespeare was deeper than most of us. And you get deeper when you read Shakespeare, and if somebody can teach you why it's deep. So I wrote my Bible commentary. It's very easy to read through the Bible, but it's very hard to understand what it has to say. It does take, usually, somebody to explain what's going on. So I just make that appeal to you that you try to pursue what is deeper, not what feels good at the moment. I mean, sex is a great example. Sex feels good at the moment. There's very little in life that feels quite as good at the moment as sex does. But when it comes with nothing else, no emotion, no commitment, no depth, it doesn't make you a happier person, especially women, because believe it or not, men and women are not the same. And it is one of the reasons that young women today, it's not the only, but one of the reasons that they are more depressed than at any time since data have been collected about young people's depression. The hookup culture has not done women a favor. And I'm not talking to you about morality or religion. This is just pragmatism. Everything deeper is better. So think about that and pursue the deep. It doesn't feel good at the moment. And it would be very funny if you said to friends, say, you know, I'm busy tonight. Would you really? What are you doing? I'm reading Dostoevsky. If you don't know who Dostoevsky is, it means you went to an American school. But Dostoevsky is a brilliant Russian writer, Crime and Punishment, and Brothers Karamazov being his best-known works. You will be a happier person at the end. And when the day or the years come that you look back at your life, you will be happier that you pursued depth than that you pursued what felt good at the moment. Desserts feel good at the moment, and there's nothing wrong with them. But if, like me, you got to watch it, I haven't had dessert in 4 months. And I've always loved it, but I feel fine. And if you're thin and it has no effect on you, have that apple pie and have a great time. And I mean that sincerely. These little joys are wonderful things in life, but you really do have to ask yourself in the final analysis, both health-wise and weight-wise, is that going to make you happier? Generally, what feels good at the moment, generally, not always, may not contribute to your ultimate happiness. So give Beethoven a try. And by the way, I have a very important suggestion. Unlike popular music, it is very rare to like a piece of classical music the first time you hear it. I'll give you one example. I'm pretty intense on this matter. I love depth. So this is going to sound really goofy to many of you. I'll risk it. About 30 years ago, I had read over and over that there's a piece for piano. It was originally written for the pre-piano instrument called harpsichord, but it's played mostly on piano, by Bach, written in the 17th century. It's called the Goldberg Variations, because a Count Goldberg commissioned him to write it. And I said to myself, if people are so crazy about this piece, I really want to see the joy that it brings. And I committed a month, I'll never forget it, a whole month, to just listening over and over. I didn't get it the first time. It was okay, but didn't move me. And now, 30 years later, I can say it may well be, along with Handel's Messiah, my favorite piece of music. I worked, this is something, again, you may never hear. I worked at getting happy. I worked, even more amazing, at having fun. It is now fun for me to listen to that piece of music. But I worked at it, and it paid off. So everything in life is ultimately a choice. How deep you want to be is completely your choice. How courageous you want to be is your choice. How good you want to be is your choice. How anything, it's your choice. Most people are not making good choices these days, like all the people who are choosing a single life over a married life. That's a good example of not so deep versus deep. Am I saying every single person is not deep? Of course not. But I am saying everyone who gets married gets deeper, even if the marriage stinks. I hope your marriage doesn't stink. But sometimes pain makes you deeper. In fact, most of the time. All right, let's move on to your questions. Here we go with number one.
Hello, Dennis. My name is Edson, coming from South Los Angeles. And my question for you is, can the United States still support Israel without sending billions of dollars over there and instead us invest that money here to clean up our communities, our cities, and strengthen our security on our borders?
Okay, so thank you, Edson. This is a really important question, and I have a really important response. This notion that it's either help Israel or any other cause outside of the United States, when we have so many problems at home, is not a tenable argument. The question sounds tenable, but it really isn't. Before aiding Israel in this regard, were we cleaning up our cities? We don't clean up our cities not because we lack money, not because money is being sent to help a country that people, vast numbers of people, want to annihilate, destroy, eradicate from the world. It's because we have done so many wrong things. Why is San Francisco emptying out? Why is downtown San Francisco a place that people now identify with fecal matter rather than gorgeous stores and shops and walks. Why? Is that because we were aiding Israel the whole time? It had nothing to do with aiding Israel. If we had never given a penny in foreign aid, and a lot of the foreign aid is nonsense, I agree, but nevertheless, had we given nothing in foreign aid, would San Francisco be okay? Would Philadelphia be okay? Would there be less crime in New York City? Would Chicago be okay? Would there not be gigantic homeless encampments in Los Angeles, where I live? All of that is a result of awful policies, not because we are sending too much money abroad. So the question is not based on reality. It's not either or. The tragedy of what is happening in America, like with an open border, it has nothing to do with, well, we spend too much money helping Israel or helping Ukraine or whatever it might be. It's because we have awful policies at home. When America was much poorer, San Francisco was a much more livable city. The issue was not money. The issue is horrible policies, foolish policies. That's why we have our problems. It is not a monetary problem. I talked to you earlier about the depression among many young women. Do you know this? I just read this recently. This blew my mind. There were fewer suicides during the Great Depression than there are now, percentage-wise of the population. The notion that money determines the quality of a society's life is so false. It's really a residue of Marxism, who explained everything in terms of economics. But it's not. If economics were the issue, Americans would have been most depressed during the Depression. But they weren't most depressed during the Depression. They're most depressed today, when there is no depression. And it's the children often of upper middle class and middle class, upper class families who are doing the worst. Remember my equation. I have equations in life. One of them is secularism plus affluence equals boredom. And boredom equals bad stuff, not to mention depression. So it's not either or, Edson. Thank you. Next. Here we go, from Spain. Julio, 29, in Spain. Hello, Mr. Prager. Over the last years, I've encountered many people from former socialist countries. And from their experiences, it seems to me that Yugoslavia was the most livable of them. As someone with great knowledge of communist history, would you agree with that take? Would you say that other countries like East Germany or Romania were significantly more oppressive for the average citizen? Thank you for your show and for all the work you do. Well, this is not exactly a question bugging a lot of people, but it shows, it speaks well of you that you even care about this. The knowledge of history is so minimal that that is a crisis for civilization. A civilization without memory will not survive. And people are asked, I see this on YouTube all the time, people ask, young people at universities, you know, till when did America have slavery? There were kids answering 20th century. I mean, when was World War I? They didn't even come close. They probably couldn't tell you anything about World War I in any event. Probably not much about World War II. They interviewed some people who were chanting from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, and they asked them, what river are you referring to? They had no idea. They were just chanting the slogan. Some of them didn't even know what sea. Anyway, to answer your question, yes, Yugoslavia was among the communist countries. The communist countries of Europe were Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, East Germany, Romania, Bulgaria, and Albania. Those were the communist countries, and Yugoslavia were the communist countries until the Cold War ended, until the Berlin Wall came down. Of them, Yugoslavia was the freest. It was still not free. but it was freer than the others. That is correct. The country that did the best economically at the time was Hungary. They called it goulash communism. You know what goulash is? It's a famous Hungarian dish.
Oh, I do know that.
So it is a delicacy. So in other words, they had their goulash and they had their communism, at least after 1956. 56 was a terrible time for the Hungarians. Okay, next.
Oh, no, we're out.
We're out already. Oh, that is so sad. See, by the way, I'm going to sound a drop self-referential, but I don't mean to be. You enjoy this each week. It's deep. Deep and fun is the best. Just to go back to my opening comments. Thank you. See you next week. Thank you for watching this video. To keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.